November 21st, 1963, 11:07 p.m., Carswell Air Force Base. Under the cover of darkness, a blue-nosed and white Boeing VC-137C touchdowns and taxis to a line of awaiting sleek and stylized black cars. As the aircraft approaches, Raymond Buck emerges from one of the black vehicles, immediately losing his hat from the blowing weather. November 22nd, 1963, 12:38 p.m., Parkland Hospital. The entire hospital is placed on alert, the first time since its construction in 1894. Doctors and nurses dressed in white line the hallways. Men in suits and hats and ties flood the emergency entrance, shouting and frantically pushing a gurney. A dark-haired woman in a pink Chanel suit joins the men. Her hands are raised, palms up in front of her face, as she screams, "I have his brains in my hand." August 1st, 1943, 2:30 a.m., somewhere off the coast of the Solomon Islands. Allied patrol boat PT-109 is rammed by Japanese destroyer Amagiri. Only 10 survive. The survivors swim in the dreadfully cold Pacific water and gather around the wreckage. Among them is a 25-year-old naval lieutenant, well-liked by his men, but unproven as a leader. He shouts to his men, "Do we swim or surrender? There's nothing in the book about a situation like this. A lot of you men have families, and some of you have children. What do you want to do? I have nothing to lose." The men fervently choose not to give up. The lieutenant spots a speck on the horizon and, knowing their relative position, knows it to be an extremely tiny island known as Plum Pudding. The soldiers abandon the wreckage and begin swimming. November 22nd, 1963, 12:29 p.m., Dealey Plaza. After a bout of misty morning rain, the sun is out warming the wet earth. Individuals are gathered on a sloping hill. Some are leaning against a dilapidated wooden fence at the top of the hill. Others stand along the sidewalk on the opposite side of Elm Street and the sloping hill. 53-year-old Abraham Zapruder, a Ukrainian immigrant, stands among the gathered crowd, holding an 8mm Bell & Howell Zoom-matic black and silver video camera. With not a cloud in the sky, the sun shines down on the assorted gatherings as a motorcade approaches. 8.5 seconds later, three shots are fired. September 23rd, 1952, 6:30 p.m., El Capitan Theater. Californian Senator and Vice President Hopeful broadcasts to the nation. He begins the broadcast with, "My fellow Americans, I come before you tonight as a candidate for the vice presidency and as a man whose honesty and integrity has been questioned." The purpose of the broadcast is to directly address the American public concerning a critical and denigrating article by the New York Times. The article accuses the senator of allowing donors to buy his influence through an unreported fund. On TV, in real time, the senator acknowledges the existence of the fund, but strongly affirms that all his personal donations, everything from his campaign supporters, are reported and public. He pauses. Dead air goes out across the nation, then decides to come clean about one personal donation not reported. He rubs his eyes and says, "Well, one thing I should probably tell you, because if I don't, they'll probably be saying this about me too. We did get something, a gift, after the election. A man down in Texas heard Pat on the radio mention the fact that our two youngsters would like to have a dog. And believe it or not, the day before we left for this campaign trip, we got a message from the Union Station in Baltimore saying they had a package for us. We went down to get it. You know what it was? It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas. Black and white, spotted. and our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, regardless what they say about it, we're going to keep him. In an instant, with the use of live TV, a rhetorical device, and a dog, Americans stopped caring about secret funds or misuse of personal donations. Because of his speech, now known as the Checker speech, that very same senator would go on to be the Vice President of America for 8 years. The senator's name is Richard Milhouse Nixon. August 5th, 1943, 8:38 a.m., plum pudding. It's day four of starvation for the survivors of PT-109. After swimming over 4 hours, they are finally out of the water and into the sand, dehydrated, malnourished, and suffering from sunstroke. It is only a matter of time before the survivors starve to death or are spotted and killed by Japanese patrols. The young lieutenant is determined to save his men. He swims alone to the next closest island of Nauru. Nauru is a much larger island, and the lieutenant deems it more likely to be inhabited. While on Nauru, exhausted, drifting in and out of consciousness, he stumbles on a boat made by islanders. Using it to return to Plum Pudding to rescue his men, they are once again unprotected, deep in enemy-patrolled waters. On the evening of August 7, 1943, the men are rescued by Allied boats PT-157 and PT-171. The 25-year-old lieutenant braved psychological and physiological exhaustion and terror, and in the end, rescued every single survivor without casualty. Although, not knowing it at the time, the lieutenant would go on to square off against Richard Nixon in the biggest American political arena. The lieutenant's name is John Fitzgerald Kennedy. In 1960, Republican Richard Nixon and Democratic John F. Kennedy are locked in a presidential race against each other. Nixon and his campaign take an early lead as the American public couldn't make up their mind about Kennedy. First, at the age of 40, he was incredibly young and inexperienced. Also, Kennedy was an ardent Catholic, and that turned people away, fearing he would transform American values. Besides, having been the vice president for 2 terms, Nixon is familiar and generally well-liked by Americans. The poll pendulum would continually swing in Nixon's favor until the first televised presidential debate. Today, this is commonplace, but prior to the invention of the television, most Americans didn't know their presidential candidates the way they should. I mean, how could they? As modern Americans, we see political faces everywhere, in memes, on social media, or on TV. We observe their body language. We study their personal lives. We read exposé articles about all the nasty things they did growing up. You see, this is why I could never run for presidency. My body language skills are dreadful as I, without even knowing, am prone to resting bitch face. My personal life is a long, sordid and tawdry list of friends, family, and lovers I've hurt, misjudged, or wronged. And quite frankly, the time I threw a snowball at Wendy Hillenfarb in the 2nd grade, breaking her nose, is most likely the least nasty thing the American public can or should know about me. What can I say? Nobody's perfect. A good majority of the nation tuned in to watch the presidential debate. It was, in fact, the first presidential debate in history to be televised. What they saw was a cool, calm, and confident Kennedy sitting next to Nixon, who appeared exhausted, underweight, visibly sweaty, sporting a 5 o'clock shadow, and an obvious look of uncertainty on his face. What John and Jane Q. Public didn't realize about the debate is that Nixon incurred a devastating knee injury while campaigning. This led to him being hospitalized. In fact, he was only recently released before the broadcast, so who knows what kind of pain or medication he was experiencing. There exists a popular aphorism regarding the 1960 presidential debate. And it goes like this. Those who watched the debate on television considered Kennedy the victor, while those who listened on the radio considered Nixon the better contender. Now, this is most likely not true. However, it makes a strong case for how the invention of the television created optics that could easily sway American support. The 1960 presidential election went to John F. Kennedy. Your mom always said that first impressions are important. Well, in this case, they were important enough to turn the political tide. In 2007, GMT Games released 1960, The Making of the President, which I'll refer to as 1960 from here forward. 1960, designed by Christian Leonard and Jason Matthews, is a spiritual successor to the epic two-player Cold War simulator and fan favorite Twilight Struggle. Similarly, 1960 is an adversarial two-player game that, according to the box, takes 2 hours to play. Although, heaven help me if any of my games of 1960 have come remotely close to ending at the two-hour mark. Seriously, you're going to want to set aside an entire afternoon for this bad boy. In 1960, each player takes on the role of either the Republican hopeful Richard Nixon or the young Catholic Democrat out of Brookline, Massachusetts, John F. Kennedy. The game is a quite complex area control experience where players attempt to win influence over American states, which in turn provide them with electoral college points at the end of the game, assuming the player still controls the state at the end. Now, from day one, I never structured this series to ever provide any in-depth explanation of rules and how to play. I don't know about you, but whenever I listen to a board game podcast and the host starts to describe every painstaking detail regarding how the game is played, I simply tune out. Personally, I strongly believe that if you're reaching outside of a game's rulebook to learn how to play, you're better suited pursuing video content. However, typically during my history and game episodes, I like to give at least some semblance of how the game plays, how do rounds work, what can players do on their turn, and the significance of their actions within the game's framework. Unfortunately, 1960 is such a beast with expansive rounds, card interactions, numerous phases, and player actions that, for the sake of keeping the runtime short, I'm forced to give a speedy idea of how the game works. It is what it is. If you're listening to this and have ever played either 1960 or Twilight Struggle, then you're picking up what I'm laying down. Okay, let's do this. The game implements card and action point versatility. Essentially, on a player's turn, they either play a card from their hand, resolving various aspects on the card in a particular order, or activate their candidate card, if possible. When playing a card, players can use it as an event or for its campaign points. Events are rather straightforward, so I'll skip them. However, campaign points may be spent to do one of the following three things. One, campaign in states, moving your candidate pawn around the board, combating or bolstering state support in an attempt to control or steal areas. Two, advertising in regions, increasing their media support within a specified region, which makes taking states in that region away from your opponent slightly easier, among other things. Three, positioning on issues. Players increase their support on three issues: civil rights, economy, or military defense. Having the most support on an issue yields bonuses and rewards in a later phase. The brilliance behind 1960 is not in its complexity, but in its marriage of mechanisms and theme. You spend time campaigning all over the board. States are easier to influence and control when you campaign in them. Investing resources to advertise and control the media makes you more popular. Taking a stance on the big issues increases momentum and grants endorsements. There's even a mini game special debate round that I'm not even going to touch on. The game feels like a lot of work, not in a bad sense, but in a, this is the type of good old-fashioned elbow grease it takes to win an election sense. If you're a savvy gamer, you may have guessed by now that there is a lot to do in 1960, and not a single bit of it feels wasted. No singular game aspect or strategy dominates over any other strategy. Everything feels valid. Naturally, the supermassive downside is that because there's a plethora of options, the game exacerbates analysis paralysis more than any other game I've played. I've often had nightmares where I'm playing 1960 and my opponent is a sloth from Zootopia. Everything is in slow motion, like we're underwater. Oof, terrifying. Jumping into my final thoughts, I'm not sure exactly what impression to leave you with. I mean, 1960 is a solid game. For me, I like the theme of Twilight Struggle, but the gameplay of 1960 is far more interesting. Now, I'm usually more of a theme guy, however, if I'm being honest, 9 times out of 10, I'd pick 1960 over Twilight Struggle to fill my Sunday afternoons. Just admitting that makes me rethink my entire gamer identity. Anyways, 1960, The Making of the President, is in a category of games that you purchase with the expectation that they'll hit the table at least once a year. It has an enormous learning curve, only plays 2, feeds the analysis paralysis monster, and is quite the time commitment. However, if all of that sounds like a warm piece of political pie you'd like to sink your teeth into, then you, my friend, will not be disappointed. My name is Andrew Davidson. I hope I have given you something to think about.